Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, January 19th, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. In the last week in particular, Lyndon LaRouche has been pointing out that we now have a golden opportunity to defeat the power of the financial empire centered in the city of London and Wall Street, as there's been an awakening of a minority of leading figures who have been aided by the deployments of LaRouche PAC activists in Washington, D.C. and throughout the nation. This small minority, which is actually a grouping above party, that is, it's from both parties, but people who are breaking with party discipline, this minority has come to realize on some level that the present course of the British-directed Obama administration, if not changed and changed quickly, will lead us to a deadly World War III driven by a hyperinflationary collapse. And that is upon us. That collapse could come at any minute. Now further, some among this minority are now heeding LaRouche's call that we must reimpose Glass-Steagall banking regulations and impeach Obama as one package if we're to get out of this. There is a blatant weakness, however, even now, in the thinking of this minority. They do not understand that the enemy we are facing is this London-centered empire, nor do they understand that this empire, as has been the case of all of its imperial predecessors, is committed to the destruction of civilization, to the destruction of humanity, if its control over populations and nations is threatened, as it is today. What we're dealing with is identified by LaRouche as the oligarchical principle. On today's program, we're going to be discussing this principle through looking at one of its first manifestations, at least one of those that has come down to us, in the imperial warfare involved in the Trojan War, especially as reported by the Greek poet Homer. Joining me today will be Gerald Rose, who's been investigating the oligarchic principle for years, especially through Homer's eyes and other Greek poets and dramatists, as well as a later incarnation of empire in Venice. And in that, he was aided by his studies of William Shakespeare, of the Venetians, and their insidious imperial method. So, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Harley.
Let me begin, as I often do, by asking, you just came from a meeting with Lyndon LaRouche. Are there any headlines from the meeting today that are relevant to our topic?
Well, you know, what Lynn focused on, and it was predicated in a certain way, but really it comes down to what is the actual ability to defeat this oligarchy? Where does it reside? And on a very fundamental level, it resides in the question of your own immortality, not your physical immortality, but a sense of identity. And that sense of identity is ensconced in roughly 5% of the population who can, as he repeated in several cases, can actually inspire another 10%. And that 15% represent the power to change the course of history.
And he's been emphasizing that this is, in fact, the deeper strategic issue, getting that leadership to recognize self-consciously that that's who they are.
Exactly. And the power, you can see the power of such ideas. And, well, really not ideas in the way that most people think of it, but commitment, intention to a future. And when you have a clear leadership that is prepared to risk all for for the future, for future generations, there's no telling what can happen. And of course, the oligarchy fears that power. As Lynn said at one point in the course of the discussion, there was a very tiny handful of men who led the American Revolution, who actually led it: Franklin, Washington, Hamilton, later, a little later, John Quincy Adams, and some groupings around them. And they inspired others to be better. And that combination really broke the chain of oligarchism from the period of Troy to, frankly, the American Revolution. There were periods in European history, particularly Charlemagne, and of course later Louis the 11th, and some breaks around Cusa, clearly, in the Italian Renaissance, which actually were the basis upon which we went from a population of several million to a population of 7 billion.
Well, before we get to the historical precedents, I just want to fill out a little bit more for our listeners the relevance of this topic, because we're looking at a situation today where we are beginning to see an emergence of these leaders, really organic leaders, including people in institutions, but also people in our institution, which should not be underestimated. But I've been doing a series of meetings in the last 10 days, and one of the questions that always comes up is, well, how can you beat these people? You can't really beat them, can you? And, you know, the point that I keep making to them is that most of them haven't really tried yet. And then it comes out the real fear that you're talking about in immortality, is that people say, well, look what happened to our good leaders. They get killed. And the point that Lynn has always made is this question of immortality, which is crucial in looking back on the Greeks, but also today, is if you don't have something that you believe in enough that you're willing to die for it, then you're just playing games.
Absolutely. And that's absolutely the case. And that's what Lynn went through today. And again, it was a certain predicated way, you know, in terms of some of the younger generations' weakened capacity. Because, I mean, look, I mean, who were the presidents for most of these period? You know, I mean, two Bush administrations, an Obama administration, that's the last 12 years. Clinton had his strengths, but he sure had his weaknesses. So this has not been a Franklin, Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy. They never really personally experienced any of this. And therefore, that shows how unique the young people in the LaRouche organization really are. Because in Lyndon LaRouche, they're experiencing, I think, you know, I say this without exaggeration, the greatest leader maybe in human history.
Well, you know, you also get at this question of the false way that most people look at history and tragedy, where they're looking for heroes, and you find there are very few heroes. I think that's a good way to start taking a look at this question of the Trojan War, because everyone has, when they first approach it, someone they sort of like, whether it's Achilles or they feel sorry for the Trojans, but that's not really the point, is it?
No. In fact, it's just fascinating. And people who've listened to me over the years, I've always been fascinated with how history works. And the relationship between that and classic tragedy, because the Iliad is written as a classic tragedy, in the sense that none of the people caught inside this horrific war understand at all the bigger picture.
Yeah, I was just saying to someone before we came on the program that if you're looking for a hero in this, there's only one, and that's Homer.
That's what I was thinking to say. Yeah. Absolutely. Because look, I mean, why did Homer do this? I mean, what is the impulse of a person like Homer, a great classical artist? The first, that at least in recorded history. And that's how I got back to him. I kept working back from Shakespeare and,
mm-hmm.
you know, got
it's
to Homer.
Starting point.
Yeah, for sure. I worked through Dante, Shakespeare. Then I said, wait a second, you know, what's this about? You know, Lynn had pointed out, and it was sort of striking to even those of us who had thought about Troy for years. You know, he made the point, I guess about 2 years ago, that the Greek tribes, which ended up on the in Troy, were a bunch of marauding bandits. And they were driven to destroy or dominate Troy by an imperial power. I mean, you could say this is Mycenaean civilization and the heroes and the whole business. But as Homer paints it, what ensued, the reason Homer chose this battle, or this period,
War, yeah.
war really,
Yeah, long war.
it was 10-year war, but
Almost as long as the Afghan War.
yeah, right. The reason he chose it is because it was known through Greek civilization that the Trojan Wars were around 1250 or so, or somewhere in that range, BC. Homer writes about 900, BC. So it's about 300 years after the war. Why does he write about it? Because there was a dark age which ensued because of the war. And Schliemann, the great Heinrich Schliemann, and then others who did the research based on Schliemann's first archaeological, really first modern archaeological dig was for Troy. What they show throughout the Mycenaean, and that's what these Greek tribes were called, the Mycenaean civilization, the so-called heroes, there was a collapse in culture, massive collapse in culture, because of the Trojan War.
And Jerry, you know, one of the things that jumps out at me when I look at this, the story behind the story that Homer knew and that people who heard him would know, is that as we see today among the imperial advocates, Zeus was an advocate of population reduction, including using war to reduce populations.
Yes, of course, that's in the Promethean trilogy.
Yeah.
But the point that Homer makes, and it's very powerful, is that the men are slaves. I mean, it's not a story about Helen's beauty and the sack of Troy. In fact, right from the very first opening, it's about the rage of Achilles. The actual story is that the Greeks, the so-called Greek heroes, destroyed themselves, in effect.
When you say slaves now, you mean enslaved by their
Enslaved
beliefs,
by
their traditions,
well, you
beliefs?
know, it's interesting. What I mean, Homer's very psychological. They're enslaved by their passions. Remember, Euripides points out, and he writes this at the height of the Peloponnesian Wars, in order to start the war in Troy, Agamemnon has to kill his daughter Iphigenia.
Right.
Right? So it starts, the war starts with a human sacrifice of his own daughter, which later comes back to haunt him as Aeschylus points out when he comes home from the war in Troy and his wife, Clytemnestra, kills him. Right?
Right.
So you have that. But what was the purpose of the war? I mean, some historians have said, and there's some reason to believe it, that Helen may not have even been, the actual Helen may not have even been at Troy.
Yeah, there's some report she was in Egypt.
In Egypt, right. Certainly Euripides says that. But other historians have said that. This was an imperial war. And the war was fought by these Greek tribes to essentially dominate that region, the Black Sea region. The Helen question is interesting. I mean, let's assume that she was there, because certainly Homer has her there, and there's no reason to believe that Homer was not a historian. Although again, you're talking about 300 years later, but the point to be made is that these wars lead to genocide and destruction.
Right.
And therefore, what Homer is doing in his way is trying to give the Greek tribes, because it really doesn't end with the Iliad, right? It's the Iliad and the Odyssey. They're written pretty much as one piece for Homer. And in the course of the piece, both pieces, particularly in the Odyssey, in the wake of the destruction of the Greek tribes on their way home, and what was going on at home, as was described in the Odyssey, where these guys who didn't go to war, these young princes now 10 years later, were just ripping the Ithaca apart, which was where Odysseus was from. You had a complete destruction.
And Jerry, isn't it the case that a lot of the people who went with Agamemnon to Troy to fight, even though they won the war, the way they ended the war, according to Homer, not Homer, but others, didn't make it home. They were just, the gods destroyed them because of the way they treated the Trojans.
That's right. That's right. That's absolutely the case. So that you see in Homer, who is the caprice of the gods, the caprice of the oligarchical principle, because as you point out, Zeus, the gods are quite mad.
Right.
In other words, why did the Greeks get slaughtered? Because Thetis, who is Achilles' mother, he sues to her because his concubine, Briseis, was stolen from him by Agamemnon.
Right.
Now, if this war was caused by women, a woman who was stolen, what's the first irony that Homer represents? Right? Achilles almost kills Agamemnon, the head of the Greek forces, because he steals his woman.
And even the backdrop to the story of how Helen became the target for Paris, you know, the so-called contest as to who is the most beautiful woman.
Right.
You know, again, you see this kind of capriciousness with the gods.
Well,
yeah.
The Aphrodite, right.
Exactly.
Right. Inflames Helen, and that's it, you know. But the point that Homer is making, and you see this ironically presented through the whole of the Trojan War, is that the gods are just in a war with each other. And the men are merely pawns to their passions, manipulated by the gods. That is not so different.
Right.
Than the British and how every empire has ever worked.
And that's how they control populations that are much larger than them. You're listening to the LaRouche Show. Today is the 19th of January, 2013, and we're speaking with Jerry Rose about this oligarchical principle, which is a relevant topic for a number of reasons, but most importantly, understanding this and acting from a higher understanding is going to be crucial in the battles we face in the weeks ahead to bring this collapsed civilization back into some kind of control by getting rid of Obama and getting the Glass-Steagall Plus three-point program of Lyndon LaRouche implemented. It's not enough to have good ideas. You actually have to understand that what you're dealing with is the nature of man and the nature of civilization. And this is no better place to look than going back to Homer. Now, Jerry, on this question of the caprice of the gods, this is actually throughout the Iliad. It comes up again and again and again, doesn't it?
Well, you see this. What's the actual war about, right? At least from Homer's standpoint, they have this war, the Greeks invade. You have, as I said, Achilles, and of course Homer's making an ironic, he's a poet. So it's not by accident that he chooses the Achilles' rage, at Agamemnon. I mean, here it starts. Presumably they're there to get Helen back from Menelaus, right? First thing that happens in the whole drama is Achilles is about to kill Agamemnon because he steals Briseis.
Right.
Now, you think that's an accident? You think that Homer's just making that up? No,
Adding a little spice to
he's
spice
making
it
a
up.
critical point here that the Greeks had no moral superiority at all. And in fact, you see after Zeus agrees with Thetis that that Achilles who will withdraw and allow the Greeks to get slaughtered. At one point, Hera, who's for the Greeks, seduces Zeus. And while she seduces him and he's sleeping, the Greeks rally to slaughter the Trojans. Right? And then Zeus wakes up, gets pissed off that his dictum to the gods to stay out of this thing and allow it to unfold in a certain way. He gets pissed off, then the Trojans rally and start slaughtering the Greeks. So the whole caprice, and of course the gods Aphrodite and Mars are on the side of the Trojans, Hera and Athena on the side of the Greeks, and at one point a mortal Diomedes wounds Ares or Mars. And he runs to Olympus and starts crying that he got wounded, right? So you see that in the drama, the only there are no heroes. Yes, there are friendships. Yes, that they but ultimately, there is certainly a certain level of pathos. Which I think is very real in the sense that Hector shows tremendous pathos when he recognizes that they are going to lose. And he says goodbye to his wife and his child, knowing what would happen.
I think also the end of the Iliad, where Achilles sees the genuine grief of Priam at the death of his son,
Right.
is another example of that, another actually human response from someone who was an arrogant, enraged character throughout most of the poem.
Exactly. And so in a certain sense, there's a certain level of pathos in the drama, right? But in reality, there were no heroes, none, none, including the way that later the Trojans were used, and of course in other tellings of the story, when they defeated the Trojans and took the women as slaves and killed Hector's son to make sure that he would never grow up to be a leader.
Yeah, they dropped him off the walls of the city.
That's right.
Yeah.
This comes back to haunt them. And then they sow salt on the earth so that they could never grow again. Right? So the total destruction of Troy, and then the total destruction of the Greeks as they returned home after a 10-year war. Doesn't it remind you of Vietnam at all?
Vietnam
Or
or Afghanistan.
Afghanistan
This is
now?
like the principle of long wars, with at a certain point, you lose sight of what was the mission of the war. If you
Well,
assume the
the
mission.
Greeks had, that's the point.
Yeah.
That was the point. Now, ironically, and I've been pointing this out in the discussions on this, Euripides, who writes in the 3rd century BC, uses the treatment of the Trojans by the Greeks, and particularly the Trojan women, at the height of the Peloponnesian Wars, in which the Athenians were the perpetrators of the war,
mm-hmm.
right, of the Peloponnesian Wars. They, right. Their imperial design put them in a situation where they were trying to dominate the whole area, right? So he's writing about the inhumanity of the Greeks in the treatment of the Trojans, and he almost gets killed by the Greeks in that war. And that war, again, ended disastrously for the Athenians, absolutely disastrously.
And Jerry, I think it's also worth noting that Aeschylus's Orestian trilogy, which takes up the return of Agamemnon from the war, also shows that here's Agamemnon, the victor in the war, and he comes back to a completely dysfunctional situation. His wife is shacked up with a former prince or former leader, and there's just another bloodbath until Orestes steps up and basically says, look, the gods decreed all this, but I still had to make a personal decision to do it, so I take responsibility.
That's right, and of course he's shown mercy by Pallas Athene.
Yeah.
But what's clear in the hands of the great poets, they see it was well known the disaster of this kind of war. In other words, all of the Greek not writings, but pottery, other things, and all the archaeological digs that occurred. You see, all these places got wiped out.
Yeah.
They're no longer metropolises or anything like that. They were faraway places. You know, you had the ships, the tally of the ships or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There were hundreds of cities that went out of existence. Literally hundreds of them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you couldn't have a clearer demonstration of what the caprice of these oligarchical forces bring on.
And mm-hmm. this, I think,
it's based upon the idea that men are fated by the gods. Mm-hmm. That while they have a certain amount of pathos, like, you know, the two meet on the battlefield and they decide, since their fathers knew each other, they would not fight each other, which is reenacted in certain cases in the Civil War, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, the whole of civilization, to the extent that they live by these oligarchical rules, the whole of that thing got completely wiped out. Now, what does Homer do in facing that? He creates in the Odyssey a different paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Aeschylus picks up the Homeric project in the image of Pallas Athene. Mm-hmm. Who guides not only Odysseus, but he also guides his son Telemachus.
Mm-hmm.
She also guides Telemachus in the famous story of Mentor. By the way, Mentor is a very powerful word because it's a reference to Pallas Athene, who is embodied in an old man who leads Telemachus to reestablish order along with his father, Odysseus, in Ithaca.
Right.
But of course, this is picked up in a very powerful way by Aeschylus And of course, as you point out, the Oresteian trilogy. And in fact, Athens is a project. It is not a place. It's a project.
Well, Jerry, let me ask you, there are a couple of questions that, lead into this, the work that Aeschylus did. The real golden age of Greece was actually before the age of Pericles.
But, that was it, yeah.
If you, two questions. One is, Homer's work was an oral tradition. It was actually a poem that was sung. I assume that this became part of the real education of the people later on, like Solon and others, who founded Athens on the basis of some higher principle than caprice.
Well, sure. I mean, of course, this is the impulse of all the epic poems. And this is this will shock people if they haven't really thought about it. Shelley says it in this beautiful way. He says, you know, the poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world, right? Mm-hmm. In his famous defense of poetry. That it's in the mind of Homer, who has witnessed this disaster. He's lived it through his imagination. And he said, how will I allow succeeding generations to think about uplifting civilization? How? Now, you know, remember, these were, as you say, bardic traditions. They were sung, and they were poetry, so they were very powerfully, they created very powerful image or metaphors in people's minds, right? The bringing together of a common language, a common tradition, and a common view of the gods, in some sense, created the Greek people.
The poem
itself, and it's never the Iliad. It's the Iliad and the Odyssey. Anybody who thinks that they're separate is a fool. Because one is a total tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
One is just slaughter and mayhem. And the other is a completely different view of man and, in effect, the gods. Right? So this epic poem, which was sung to thousands upon thousands over hundreds of years, is the common culture that led, as you point out, to Solon. But in the hands of an Aeschylus, it goes to a whole higher level.
Now, one of the points you just made about a common tradition that is hard
and language
for, and well
language.
And language, but it's hard for us to, with our crappy educational system, to actually appreciate, is that when Homer is talking about the gods and you have these stories, this is something which is known. They didn't have Edith Hamilton's book on mythology. This was part of the tradition and culture. You know, people knew these stories, how the language developed in many cases out of these myths.
Yeah, and you know, but you know, I want to make a point which I've made before, but I want to see if I can sort of be more rigorous about it. See, there's a difference between myth and legend. And I think it's a very important difference.
Mm-hmm.
See, very often myths, and you get people like Carl Jung and you get others, right, like this Fraser and others who, you have this so-called cyclical myths, right, in which, you know, Mother Earth, and there are cycles with her, and there are cycles with all sorts of other things, right? Creation, destruction, you know, this yang-yang business.
Even things like the character of Jesus as the Messiah.
Yeah, right, exactly, right. You know, so you have these myths, right, which, you know, on one level, with seasons and other things, people create. But then you have legends. And legends are often actual histories, maybe somewhat heightened, right? As most poets and others would be, but they're actual histories. And they're actually the ways that why people do the things that they do. So you have a legend. And that's what Homer is taking up.
But this is actually more of a truthful approach to history. If you look at Schiller, for example, the story of Maria Stuart. I was just bringing this up the other day because people were asking me what I thought of the Lincoln movie, and I said it lacked something of a Schillerian touch because it was too close to the text. And if you think about something like Maria Stuart, where he added the scene of Maria and Elizabeth actually meeting. Similarly, what Homer does, what I wanted to ask you is how important was it that Schliemann actually found that this was a real site and there was a real history to it, that in the hands of the poet created a civilization?
Yeah, well, that's the point. In other words, I if with Shakespeare, with Schiller, certainly, and he's explicit about it, Shakespeare's explicit about it. They are first and foremost historians. Because these stories are true. They happened. They're what shape a civilization's consciousness of itself, right? And therefore the impulse is to take a reality and give people a sense through this irony to make them think, to force them to think. Because anyone, the famous one, of course, is Prometheus here, right? Zeus is supposed to be the god of gods, right? Right? And he's going to wipe out civilization, right? He says it. And Prometheus says, no, I'm not going to let you do that. And goes down and steals fire from Hephaestus and gives it to mankind. Who would you be rooting for at that point? You think these Greek tribes are sitting there saying, hey, yay, Zeus?
Well,
You know, and
the other point of Prometheus, Jerry, is that part of Zeus's anger at Prometheus is that Prometheus won't tell him what's going to happen to him.
yeah, exactly, exactly. So
You have the forecasting question come in.
yeah, right. That's absolutely the case. That's absolutely the case. But the point is that Homer, on the one hand, again, there's human pathos, right? But it's a disaster. It's a disaster. And in fact, you have Achilles speaking in the second volume, in the Odyssey, in Hades. And Achilles says, you know, I would really much rather be alive. I don't care what heroism I've committed. I'd much rather be alive, which was almost censored, by the way.
Well, and that was the irony of immortality, because the whole issue with Achilles was he was offered this opportunity either to live a relatively boring life for a long time or to die heroically on the battlefield and become immortal.
But then Homer brings him back at Hades and says, God, I made a stupid mistake. And of course, Homer, at the end of the Odyssey, you have a massive time reversal in which, again, all the suitors are killed. They go down to Hades, and who do they meet there? But Clytemnestra and Agamemnon.
And of course, Jerry, there's no reason why Achilles would be limited to those two choices.
No, none, none. But the point is, look at the time reversal in the Odyssey, right? In which they whereas Agamemnon says to those suitors, for centuries to come, for time to come, people will sing of the fidelity of Penelope, and they will speak of the unspeakable Clytemnestra. So Homer, you can't look at the Iliad without looking at the Odyssey. It's a big mistake.
And I think
because the two together, he references in very sorrowful terms the war.
Well, just to make this point on what you just made of the time reversal, this actually gets to another point that Lyndon LaRouche has always made on these things, which is that the beginning is determined by the end, and that you have a composition which is an unfolding of a process which is already completed in the mind of the composer.
Absolutely, and that isn't that interesting that the first great epic poem in Western civilization is a piece of thorough composition, and it's sung. I was thunderstruck by that. This is a poem that lasts over 2 weeks. And he sustains the line and then ends with this incredible time reversal.
Yeah.
I mean, these principles of composition are the human mind. It has nothing to do with rules. Nothing to do with rules. There were no rules.
But that's, of course, totally lawful, because the people who created these compositions were people who thought differently, who actually were able to get above the questions of the caprices and the passions and the public opinion
of their
day.
And that's why Shelley says at the end, the poets are the unacknowledged legislators.
Well, you're listening to The LaRouche Show, and I hope this last, especially this last 10-minute discussion, made clear to you why classical culture is so essential. Because you look today at our situation, and of course, we look at the Congress, we look at Obama, we see there are no heroes there. So is there someone to cheer for? The typical American is looking, who's the good guy? Who can we back? And the Homer of today is essentially saying, you have to emerge, and you have to think outside of the crisis, and you have to be coming up with a solution for the future, which can be applied today.
And I tell you, again, I had to read this in translation because, I'm a product of our American education. I almost learned no languages. I assure you, it's much more powerful. But in Chapman's Homer, which Keats references in a famous sonnet, you get this incredible sense. You see, because some of these things are romantic, some of these translations are romantic, and they really think the story is about Helen on some level, right? Whereas the great Elizabethan...
Well, and the heroic sacrifices and struggles.
Yeah, the heroic sacrifices and struggles. Whereas the Elizabethans, who were not romantics because of Shakespeare, and of course Chapman was part of this whole cultural revolution going on, are speaking of statecraft, are speaking of how nations are destroyed. It's very clear in Chapman's Homer, because I've read other, listened to other Homers, in Chapman's Homer, the point is just absolutely clear. It is about how these passions are just absolutely rip apart both the Greeks and the Trojans. And these passions are, in a sense, manipulated by the gods of Olympus. And they constantly reference Priam and others, say, we, you know, this war, why we're here, this was all the caprice of the gods. And when you say that, or when, you know, I think Megan Beats did it beautifully on Wednesday, you know, when you say, oh, there's nothing I can do about it, what are you really saying?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Think back to Troy. You know, think back to the everything that's happened. And think back to our founding fathers. What have they said? Oh, you can't beat them.
Well, also, Jerry, it goes to the point you just made about the Clytemnestra comment on Penelope, this idea that what Homer did was create people who are immortal as individual characters, not necessarily the actual figure, because I don't think he interviewed Clytemnestra in hell. But this higher truth that lives on about what people do with their lives is something that very, very few people think about it. I mean, it's typified by George W. Bush, who said, was asked, what do you think history will make of you? And he said, what do I care? I'll be dead. That you actually had a different sense of, you have a different sense in poets of this question of immortality.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And, you know, but I want to get back to the original point I made. You know, the great poets, every single one of them, Shakespeare, what's the first thing he writes? A history play, the history plays. It's the first thing he writes,
mm-hmm.
Right? Homer, history. What's Dante? The history. In other words, the idea that the poets are somehow making fantasizing, as opposed to what Shelley calls imagination.
Exactly, yeah.
Right? Imagination is not by any means fantasizing. Imagination is the insight into and a powerful insight and a metaphor which the poet has of what man actually is.
And it's based, as Schiller says, on the individual poet's personal responsibility for developing their own character, for self-development, that you can't just sit down and scrawl a verse. You actually have to go through a process of stripping away the part that's controlled by sense perception and developing an imagination.
And being powerfully committed to the uplifting of mankind.
Yeah.
If that is not what you're doing, but not uplifting in the sense of exhortation or of didactic things, right? By showing the irony, by out of the corner of the person's eye, in the Odyssey, particularly in the Iliad, out of the corner of their eye, you say, wait a second. rather than get swept up into the sense certainty thing, wait a second, this thing is crazy. And not in a didactic way, you know, and therefore it's very rare that anyone speaks of the Iliad and the Odyssey as one piece.
I was just going to ask you, from the research you've done over the years, are there any so-called Greek scholars around today who have this understanding?
None, not one.
They're all trapped in a certain perverted view of what a tragedy is.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it takes them outside of their own responsibility to avert the tragedy which we
live. Well, it's only from the standpoint of Lyndon LaRouche could you understand any of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in other words, it's not so unique that, you know, the researchers under Lynn would incorporate Schliemann and the implications of Schliemann's discovery. Remember, Schliemann demonstrates that in the wake of this war, a dark age, a depopulation of dark age ensued, which always happens when you get oligarchical systems. Not sometimes, always. Look at the Venetian system, the old Venetian system, led to the Black Death. You look at these systems, they lead to disasters. And unless you embed it in the implications of Schliemann's discoveries, and they were discoveries, and it's interesting that Schliemann, the British historiography said, oh yeah, Homer was a great poet, he had a great imagination, this kind of thing. And Schliemann said, no way, no. This is real history. Mm-hmm. And that's by the way, that's a pretty big breakthrough. I mean, as it demonstrates the hypothesis, if anyone says that art is some kind of fantasy or a fantasy, right?
Right.
This is a absolute refutation that it has nothing to do with that. That the classical tradition comes from a passion to display to man his foibles and to show where these lead.
And actually, that's the higher compassion, is to be able to literally strip bare the effects of uncivilization of people who give into these kinds of passions.
There's no question about it. And so therefore, it's what Schiller says. I mean, frankly, it was Schiller who gave me the initial insight into this stuff, in terms of the reading of Schiller. And he is explicit about his method of historic research, mm-hmm. right? I mean, he was literally a historian.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like he sort of did history and then did tragedy. He was first and foremost a historian. And a brilliant one at that, and wrote several extensive histories of the Netherlands, of all the plays that he wrote were, in effect, a recasting of the history to give people an insight into what went wrong.
I mean, one of the best places to find that, you mentioned the Revolt of the Netherlands and then the play Don Carlos, and then he wrote letters on Don Carlos to make sure that the method that he was applying was clear to people.
Yeah, absolutely. So the point is that once I looked into the Schliemann thing, I said, oh my God, this is it. This is the absolute refutation that art is somehow a fantasy. Every single great classical artist, from Homer to Shakespeare, to Dante before, to, of course, Schiller, always starts with what are we facing as a civilization?
It actually shows a higher moral responsibility for a poet or a dramatist, that they can't simply go stream of consciousness or feeling state, but they actually do have that commitment to the improvement of mankind.
Absolutely. They live, as Macon pointed out in this question of thorough composition, their sense of time and space is rooted in an intention for the future. And therefore, they're in effect looking back, even if it's in their moment, right? But they're always looking back in terms of an intention, and therefore the whole poem or the whole piece is what we call thorough composition. So what we're saying is completely unique and original, though, it's clear.
But it also gives you an appreciation for the other great thinkers who go back to these ideas. I was just thinking as you were saying this of the profound irony of Rembrandt's painting of the blind Aristotle looking at the bust of Homer, and that these kinds of ironies are brought to life again by every generation where you do have people who think on these levels.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we've but what Lynn said, and I never quite got it, you know, until he said it, that this is the first elaboration of the oligarchical principle. Mm-hmm. So therefore, in that sense, it bears study. Because when you say there's nothing we can do, it's fated to happen, that is not a real statement. That is not a statement of truth. That's a statement of the oligarchical principle. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
All you're saying is I'm a slave to this principle. When you know, and now to be an American and to be a slave, and you say you're a patriot. You say you're a patriot, but there's nothing we can do.
Yeah.
You're not a patriot. You're not an American.
Yeah.
The whole point, which Lincoln made time and time again, is government of, for, and by the people. So if you say there's nothing we can do, you're not an American. You're actually, in fundamental principle, you're not an American. You're not a patriot. So don't get caught saying that.
Well, Jerry, we have just a couple more minutes. Just if you can, to restate the premise of this discussion has been that we're facing the kind of civilizational crisis, only with nuclear weapons, it goes beyond spears and swords and things.
No.
But we're facing that kind of crisis. The solution rests with the population, rests with the people who are on this call. But obviously, the lesson of Troy, the Trojan Wars, is precisely what you just said, that you can never give in to this simple pessimism or fatalism about a situation.
Well, we know where it leads. You can't, every damn time people succumb to this system, this oligarchical principle, it's led to a disaster. Which is Homer was looking at that. And therefore, in his principle of Pallas Athene, which is the goddess of justice and wisdom, which dominates in the return of Odysseus and the seeking of Telemachus for justice for his father and for the state, this becomes a dominant theme and becomes what later becomes the great culture of Athens,
which is the has been the basis for every Renaissance since.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Well, we need to have, and we're almost out of time. Our listeners are used to thinking through some of these questions and then running off into their regular business. And I think the lesson of Troy, as we've been discussing for this last hour, is highly relevant for now. If Obama is re-inaugurated and there's no opposition to that, and he gets away with the Benghazi and with the destruction of the Constitution, with his expansion of the Patriot Act, his drone warfare, his manipulation of the so-called debt ceiling and the fiscal cliff to rip up Social Security and Medicare and impose this Hitlerian medical policy, this is clear that this is what's happening. We have a way out, the LaRouche three-point program and the impeachment of Obama. And from tragedy, our listeners should be given a sense that you can lift yourself above this and fight. And if you don't, you end up in what can be easily forecast as a destruction of civilization. So act this week, move your congressman, get on conference calls, get people mobilized, and contribute to this fight. So Jerry, I'd like to thank you for your insights today. I think this was quite useful to take this trip into the classics.
Great. Great. Thank you so much, Carl.
All right. And we'll be with you next week, next Saturday, 3 p.m. as usual for the LaRouche Show. Thanks for joining us and see you next week.